To Inside Voices, a well-read magazine between the pages podcast. I'm Robert Gwaltney with Jeffrey Del Often this evening, and we're excited to enter into conversation with literary power couple Jason Kyle Howard and Silas House. First, before we begin our conversation, a little bit about Silas. He's a New York Times bestselling author of seven novels, including Lark Ascending, which I just read and loved. Which was a book editor's choice and is the winner of the 2023 Southern Book Prize and the Novelist Book Award. In 2022, he was recipient of the Duggins Prize, the largest award for an LGBTQ writer in the nation. In the following year, he was inducted as the Poet Laureate of Kentucky for 2023 to 2025. He was executive producer and one of the subjects of the documentary Hillbilly, winner of the LA Film Festival's Documentary Prize and the Foreign Press Association's Media Award. His novel Southernmost is currently in pre-production as a feature film. Silas teaches at Berea College, where he is the National Endowment for the Humanities Chair, and at the Naslin Mann Graduate School of Creative Writing. A native of Eastern Kentucky, he and Jason now live in Lexington, and he was recently nominated for a Grammy.
And the other half of this rather intimidating power couple is Jason Kyle Howard, a journalist and nonfiction writer for 20 years. His feature stories, as well as his social and political commentary, have appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The New Republic, Town and Country, Oxford American, and NPR, and that's just to name a few. The breadth of topics examined by Jason's keen mind and nimble pen include how the media should cover Trump's indictment, Queen Elizabeth II's death, heirs' property rights of Black South Carolinians, and a gay coal miner suing energy conglomerate Massey Energy for sexual harassment and gender discrimination. Howard is the author of A Few Honest Words, an exploration of how Kentucky has shaped American music. And he and Silas wrote both Something's Rising, an unflinching look at mountaintop removal coal mining, and the story for the Grammy-nominated music video of In Your Love by Tyler Childers. Jason serves on the faculty of Spalding University's Naslin Mann Graduate School of Writing. Suffice to say, we could go on all evening. The entirety of the podcast simply summarizing the accomplishments of Silas and Jason, but let's not do that. Let's jump to the interview. And for that, I turn it back over to Robert.
Right. So if we encountered each other at a cocktail party, probably one of the things that we would want to know is, how did the two of you meet?
Well, actually, I was living in DC for a long time, about 7 years, and we met out at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, where Silas was given doing a reading with the Washington Post Fall for the Book Festival. And I had read, being from southeastern Kentucky, I had read a couple of his novels. And so I went out to meet him. And, you know, we talked for a long time, and that was that. And then I was at the time writing for a magazine in DC, and I was also just starting to do freelance writing on the side. And so I pitched a piece on Silas, and the magazine took it. And so I interviewed him, and what was intended to be a 1 hour interview turned into a 4 hour interview.
But at a Waffle House.
At a Waffle House. Yeah. Talk about your Southern credentials. And then though, we really got to know each other at the Appalachian Writers Workshop in Eastern Kentucky. So that's how we became friends first, and were friends for a long time. So,
and we wrote a book together. So,
and we survived.
And you survived it. So Timothy and I, when we got back in from, actually, was Jeffrey and I were both in Kentucky at the Louisville Book Festival this past weekend. Timothy picked me up from the airport. We ate at the Waffle House, and I had the All-Star breakfast. Any of you fans of the All-Star?
Or Jess. Sometimes you just got to have it.
You do.
Well, that's a great origin story. Speaking of, you know, origin stories, I am interested to hear, Silas, about the title of Lark Ascending, your most recent novel. So Lark Ascending is the name of a sublimely beautiful piece for violin and piano by Rayfawn Williams. And and which I think is inspired by the poem of the same name by George Meredith, a 19th century poem. Did either of those or both of those works inspire you? Will you tell us about that and the origin for this novel?
Mostly the piece of music. It's, you know, it's a 14-minute, one-movement piece of classical music, and I just think it's transcendent. And I was, as soon as I created the main character for this book, I knew his name was Lark. I don't know why. That was just always his name, and it seemed to suit him well. And when I'm working on a novel, I sort of go out into the world and I'm just looking for whatever the universe is going to offer me that might serve the novel. And so for the first time ever, I heard The Lark Ascending on the BBC. And I just thought that's the soundtrack for this novel, because the song is a journey, and it sort of covers the emotional terrain in 14 minutes that it takes me almost 300 pages to cover in the novel, you know. And it just, it sounded like the book to me. And I was just so profoundly moved by the piece that I wanted to use it. I have probably listened to that now 1,000 times, and it still moves me every time. So I say everywhere I go, if this book does one thing positive, I hope it's that it makes people listen to that piece of music.
Well, you know, the violin in this piece is so mournful, you know, and I think that you capture that in the novel. You expand it, you transcend it to, you know, a different kind of medium, an art in itself. Does music, do you listen to music for inspiration for your other works, or you, Jason, as well? How do other forms of art inspire you to do what you do?
Go ahead. Yeah, music has always been a huge part of my process. If I know a character's name and their favorite song, I can create the character. Mm-hmm. But I have to know their song. And it's sort of like everything grows out of that for me. And then I also have, you know, a musical landscape for the novel itself, and just several different layers of that. I don't know how not to do that. But also I look at I look at paintings and photographs, and poetry is a major foundation for all of my novels. Whatever the theme of the novel is and wherever the novel is set, I look for poetry that speaks both of those elements, and that helps to ground me. It's sort of like a little prayer or meditative state that I'm able to go into before I start writing. I'll read that poem aloud, and it transports me to that world that I need to be in. So I always have a touchstone poem for each novel, but then I'll have a certain poem for each character. I just think that when you're spending years with a novel, you have to do whatever it takes, and you just have to figure out these little ceremonies that work for you. And they may not, you know, another writer's ceremony may not work for you, but you just have to figure out what does work for you.
And this is one way that we are different in some sense. I mean, music is one of my passions. I write a lot about music. I've written a lot of profiles of musicians, wrote a book about music. I'm a musician myself, you know, just around the house and everything. But Silas, when he writes, he can, you know, he will sit there in front of his laptop and write and be fully immersed in a scene in the moment, just turning it out and music blaring. You know, I cannot do that. My brain just goes somewhere. I get so distracted by it, because even if it's a song I know really well, I'm trying to think of the chord structure of it, or I'm listening to, you know, Barbara Streisand's voice, or and hearing a different shade or tone or something like that. So I can listen sometimes to classical music when I write, but I usually tend to prefer silence. But now when I'm working on a book, or even an extended long piece of journalism, sometimes I will usually create like a playlist that I can listen to when I'm not actually writing, some songs that to me speak to what I'm writing about or inform the piece of writing. And so if I'm taking the dog for a walk or going on a walk around the neighborhood, I will still be in that headspace that I think that, you know, the songs that I've chosen put me in for the sake of the book. So I try to use music that way.
I think my ear, Jason, snagged on you saying that you were a musician yourself. Is that correct? Talk a little bit about your life as a musician.
Yeah, well, I began playing the piano when I was six. I grew up in this little Southern Baptist church, and which is a whole other story.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm sure we can talk about that.
Yeah, get a witness there. And I was always fascinated by the piano, and when a piano solo or whatever would come on the radio, my ears would kind of perk up. And so I told my parents I wanted to learn. And so I started taking lessons and did that for 6 or 7 years. And then I started kind of playing by ear, and just going off and doing that really. And that was really informed by the churches as well. And so piano is my main instrument, and I have a good ear in terms that I can pick out really most anything. But I really wish I was a good guitar player.
He's very annoying because he can play anything he wants to.
So what about you, Silas? Do you play an instrument?
I sort of beat at a guitar, you know, I sort of have three chords and the truth, and that's about it. I grew up singing. I've always loved to sing. I'm not a great instrumentalist.
And this was a big bonding experience for us. I mean, you were talking about when we first met and we're getting to know each other is music. And, you know, we would back then make mix CDs, of our favorite songs and would sing together and play together. So that was a big touchstone.
So you may
have a really emotional connection to the music and inspired by that. But Jason, you seem to have a more technical, you seem to examine it more technically too.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. You know, although I do have that initial kind of formal training, most of what I go to now and have for, you know, 20, 25 years has been just the sounds of it and trying to duplicate that on my own versus like a formal study of it. But yeah, I'm always thinking of like the chord structure and, oh, what are they doing there? They chose to go to this minor instead of another place. And yeah, there's something in me that I can't always, even if I've heard a song a lot, that I can't always turn off.
Would you say that, so I, we've talked a bit about process, and so, you know, we all have a different way of getting to that space where the world, you know, that world that we're creating comes out of us. I think of it sort of as a time machine, you know, especially if you're going back in time to another period, not even if it's just a couple of decades ago. Do you do that? And how do you do that? Is music your time machine? Is music your main inspiration for getting ideas for what you write?
When I'm writing a period piece, I mean, music is definitely the way to step back in time easily. But I also think a lot about clothing. I think a lot about fashion. And, you know, I wrote a book set in 1976. And so for just about every day, it's from the point of view of a 10-year-old boy. So I wore Chuck Taylors about every day. And I felt the ground under my feet the way he did. And sometimes I would go stand in the creek, you know, the way he would. And so I'm a bit of a method writer in that way. I really try to surround myself with as much of the pop culture of the time period as well, not just the music, but everything that was going on. I watch, you know, the films of the period, et cetera. I really love that immersive experience of research.
And I do too. I've written quite a bit about Anne Boleyn, who is one of my kind of touchstones, and I'm, you know, just have been a history nerd since I was a kid. And so when I write about her, you know, I'm listening to all the great Tudor songs and the compositions of Thomas Tallis and the Coventry Carol or something. You know, sometimes that will come on, especially during the holidays, and I will get a shiver down my spine to think that, you know, Anne Boleyn heard this song and things like that. So yeah, music always puts me in a particular historical place or time period.
Yeah, I read that you were fascinated by Anne Boleyn, Jason. Why are you so drawn to her?
Well, I think so. When I was a kid, I was always reading. I'm an only child, and my father was a high school history teacher, and so I was always reading biographies from when I was first could read. My parents would buy me these little. I would demand like these little slender biographies of the presidents and first ladies and Queen Victoria and things like that. And so I was always interested in that. And then my paternal grandmother, one day I was 8 and I came in from playing outside during the summer. She was in for a visit and she was working with a genealogist to do our family tree. And she called me over to the table and pointed at this really poor quality Xerox copy. And she said, Anne Boleyn, her mother was a Howard, one of your distant ancestors. Very distant. And so that, you know, whether that's right or, you know, correct or not, that just exploded in my little mind. And so that was like my first moment of fascination with her. And so I would daydream about her. And I wrote papers on her when I was in middle school and high school. And she just kind of, she was like this imaginary friend I had as a child and then became almost like an older sister and a maternal figure for me, that I've measured my life against. Sometimes I think she really helped me to come out in a way, because, you know, when I was so scared and on the precipice, I would think, wow, I would think outside myself and think what she went through and experienced and how strong and courageous she was. And, that I needed to find some of that metal in me.
Love that. You know, since we're talking about childhood, I grew up in a small town in Grady County in Southwest Georgia, a place called Cairo. And of course, when I was coming along, I was a boy of the 70s and a teenager of the 80s. And there were no positive role models. And of course, you know, the world was quite a different place then for boys like us in small rural places. And I had a lot of difficulty imagining a future for myself. Mm-hmm. When you were coming along, what did you both imagine for yourselves in the future as young people?
I could never imagine having the life that I wanted. I could never imagine having the relationship that I wanted. I was just raised in such a strict fundamentalist community and culture where everything was so prescribed. And I knew that, you know, I just thought I would never have that. And I would just, you know, have to live my life sort of like a half life. The only sort of role models that I remember having, you know, the only people that I knew for sure, famous people that was famous, was Tennessee Williams. Mm-hmm. And I admired the way that he lived his life openly and honestly, and but I also just saw him as, you know, somebody that had enough money to do that and had broken the bonds of his family enough to do that, and I didn't think I could ever have that. I didn't have a whole lot of hope, and sort of decided to pray the gay away for many years, you know, which is something that you're taught in a fundamentalist upbringing, until, you know, I met somebody that I just couldn't be without. And so once I met Jason, I knew that I could have that life.
Well, and Silas, it seems like you have sort of you have a relationship with your family and community on your own terms. You're very close to your community. You have a great sense of, from a fan watching, it feels like you've sort of created the world, as you said, that you wanted, but you haven't broken those bonds as Tennessee Williams did. You enjoy all of that. How have you all done that?
Well, there's quite a bit of my family that I don't ever see, and I still miss them and I still love them. but it's impossible to have a relationship with people who can't accept you for who you are, you know? And so that's a constant heartache for me. I'm really lucky that I have my parents, you know, and that we've remained close. And I have a few cousins and such, but, you know, a whole lot of people, I just never see them because I know the way they believe in. Even worse, I know the way they vote, and I can't abide it. You know, I can love people from afar. Boundaries are a great thing sometimes.
Great.
Yeah, and for me, I really was coming of age in the mid-90s, and so I think I had more examples, I guess, in pop culture, and people that I was looking to. And so, I mean, I was raised, even orientation aside, I was raised by my parents to leave, to leave Appalachia. And we traveled a lot when I was a kid. And so I had that kind of context. And I also wanted to leave. I was really hungry to get out. So I had that in me already. And then by the time, you know, the mid-90s came around and, you know, I was having my sexual awakening, I knew that I would have to leave to survive and to thrive. And I was also, you know, pop culture was so good for me, at least, because I would see somebody like Madonna, you know, embracing gay men, or I mentioned Barbara Streisand earlier. She was really important to me, or reading a biography of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and her literary life, and it pointing me in the direction of a lot of gay men and everything. So I had that, but I was also derailed at some point there by fundamentalism and culture of shame and everything. And also I was a senior in high school when Matthew Shepard was murdered. So I saw that side of it reflected as well.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that with us. That's really powerful for people to hear, I think.
You know, your lives and your work reflect a profound respect for the land and people and animals that inhabit it. Where does this appreciation come from for both of you?
Well, I think we were both really lucky to grow up outside. We both spent a lot of time outside, and the natural world was right at our fingertips. I think often the natural world was a refuge for me. My father is a Vietnam vet who had terrible PTSD. And so, I mean, he was never abusive in any way, but it was a very nerve-wracked household. And the best course of action was to stay outside. You know, now that I'm an adult, he has sought treatment for that, but he never did that until I was outgrown and had left the house. And so the natural world was a safe place for me. I just spent all my time in the creek and in the woods and with animals. I've never not had a dog, and dogs have always been a balm for me. That's another thing that really joins us. And I think that art builds empathy, but I also think that there has to be something else that creates a deep empathy in you to be an artist, you know? So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy or something. You have to be empathetic to appreciate the art, and then the art makes you more empathetic. So I think for me, I've always been saved by the natural world and by the arts.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess a similar story with me is I go back to the fact that I was an only child, and my parents, again, were both teachers, and they really were intentional about raising me to be independent, to be able to entertain myself and to not be bored. And so I would spend time in my father's record collection or take a book outside to read. But I always, gravitated towards animals, and especially dogs. And I think when you when you're a little gay boy who maybe not, doesn't even have language for that, but you feel not seen or not fully seen, I would say in my case, because my family and my extended family certainly saw me. I was the little golden child of my community, my holler in a lot of ways, but I was never fully seen, and I knew that from a young age, or fully understood. And so I always felt like my literary heroes, or the people in these biographies that I read, or my childhood dog was just always there and just knew me.
Telling one's story, artists telling their stories, whether it be through writing or, you know, music or painting or whatever the whatever form, it's really powerful. And it sounds like you've responded to other people being brave enough to speak their truth, however they do it. What responsibility do you think that the arts and those who create art have to do that, to speak sometimes uncomfortable truths?
I think, especially being from Appalachia and feeling like you're from a place where your representatives are not really representing you, especially if you're an LGBT person, you feel, you know, often you feel like you have taxation without representation. And so I think often you turn to your artist to fulfill a lot of those responsibilities. You want your artist to speak out for you and to fight for you. And so I was lucky to have a lot of models in Kentucky of people doing that. I mean, if you think of three of the great social justice writers of our time, they're from pretty near where we grew up, Barbara Kingsolver, Bell Hooks, and Wendell Berry. And you know, I was aware of them from a pretty young age, and they sort of influenced, they did no sort of about it. They influenced me, you know, to feel like I needed to speak up too. And, you know, especially about the environment and LGBTQ issues.
Yeah.
Why is the environment so important for you all? And Jason, I didn't mean to cut you off if you talk about that as well.
No, I'm good. Yeah, the environment for me, I mean, I think in some ways, so I was coming of age in the 90s, but my early childhood was in the 80s. And so I was raised in the same community that my parents had been raised in. And they gave me in some ways a lot of freedom, is that, you know, I spent so much time outside and wading in the creeks and exploring the mountains, riding bikes with friends and everything. And so I think that love of the land seeped in that way, but also I always grew up with such a knowledge of my family's history of the land. You know, last year there was in August 22 flooding that decimated a swath of eastern Kentucky, and I saw some of that growing up, a lot of flooding. But I was also reminded every year that happened, or every time it would come back around, that my mother and father's generation had been impacted by that. My parents were first generation college graduates, and so I always knew that I was one generation removed from poverty, one generation removed from welfare. And my mother would point across the road to where we lived, to this field that she grew up in, that would flood every year, and just would always remind me of that and where she came from.
I think also when you grow up in a place of extraction, you either have to totally embrace it or you have to fight against it. And I mean, I'm from a family of coal mining people. My grandfather was a coal miner who lost his leg in the mines. He had black lung. it was a major part of our community and our culture. And I grew up across from a massive strip mine, and seeing that ridge that I love so much be destroyed as a child, it made me into an activist. Whereas it just made other people in the community feel sort of complacent or powerless. It can go either way, I think, when you're seeing the land devastated, you know, on a daily basis.
How about when you see how what it does to the individuals? I mean, I'm thinking of the video, the beautiful video and the storyline between these two men who love each other. And you know, it's a story about environment as much as it is about a story about, you know, the impact on humans, not just humanity, but these two individuals.
Yes. It was Jason's idea for the that love story to be two coal miners. And it was actually the director's idea, even though he's not from Appalachia, for one of them to have black lungs. So as soon as he said that, I thought, well, that's perfect. Yeah. That adds a whole other layer to this video of the culture, which, of course, you're zooming in on there. So I do love that aspect of it.
Well, this video that we're referencing has some historical value attached to it, in that I believe that it is the first video being nominated featuring a gay storyline. Did I get that correct?
It's the first country music video to be released by a major label that has a gay storyline. They're still trying to find out if there's ever been a country music video nominated for video of the year before. They're researching that. I'm not sure, but it's definitely, it would be one of the handful, you know, best video usually goes to, you know, the Beyoncé's or the Taylor Swift's or the big pop stars. So,
and this year it's interesting because in that category, you know, there are five nominees and there are two gay themed videos. Yeah. So
it's a good year for us.
It is. It absolutely is.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations on that. And we are coming to the close of our time together. And I think we could go on and on and on. It's been a pleasure, Jason and Silas. And thank you so much for taking the time out to meet with Jeffrey and me today.
No, we've loved it.
Thank you. I hope we can all get together in person sometime.
Yes. I would very much love that.
You would love that. Thank you. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank y'all.
Yes, thank you.
So, gentle listeners, until next time, I'm Robert Gwaltney for Inside Voices.
And I'm Jeffrey Dale Lofton. And I leave you with my creative North Star. To be creative is to be courageous.